Chapter 7. Learning from Children. Are we alone? This question is among the most fundamental humanity confronts. The moment we have a conclusive answer, negative or positive, is the moment we face profound realizations. Indeed, there are few cosmological questions of equal importance. To be sure, it would be transformative to learn what preceded the Big Bang, where the matter sucked into a black hole goes, or what theoretical insights finally square relativity with quantum physics. Indeed, I have devoted a significant portion of my life and career to answering the first two of these questions. But would the answers to these questions change our sense of ourselves as significantly as learning that we are just one intelligent species among many, or, conversely, that we are the only conscious intelligence to arise in the universe? I doubt it. Because I believe this question is so consequential, I find it remarkable how rarely and how cavalierly scientists have gone about seeking an answer. That didn't start with the resistance to my light sail theory. Far from it. Scientists' reluctance to read the messages of Oumuamua long predates its passing through our solar system. The search for extraterrestrial life has never been more than an oddity to the vast majority of scientists. To them, it is a subject worthy of, at best, glancing interest and, at worst, outright derision. Few of repute have dedicated their careers to advancing the field, and even at its zenith of academic respectability in the 1970s, only about 100 scholars were publicly associated with the SETI Institute. Far more speculative fields of mathematical gymnastics are known to attract bigger communities of physicists. The more rigorous approach to SETI began in 1959 when two physicists based at Cornell University, Giuseppe Cocconi and Philip Morrison, co-authored a seminal paper titled Searching for Interstellar Communications. Their article, which was published in the prestigious scientific journal Nature, made two simple conjectures. First, that extraterrestrial civilizations as advanced as ours, if not more so, existed. Second, that such civilizations would most likely broadcast their interstellar communication, "We exist," at the radio frequency of 1.42 gigahertz, that unique, objective standard of frequency which must be known to every observer in the universe. Cocconi and Morrison were referring to the 21-centimeter wavelength of neutral hydrogen, the very same radio emission that would preoccupy me and other astrophysicists nearly half a century later as we attempted to peer back in time to the cosmic dawn. The paper was an immediate sensation, heralding the birth of SETI and establishing the rationale for all subsequent searches for extraterrestrial intelligence with its concluding sentence, "The probability of success is difficult to estimate, but if we never search, the chance of success is zero." For me, it echoes a much older thought, one attributed to Heraclitus of Ephesus. If you do not expect the unexpected, you will not find it. Cocconi and Morrison's paper also brings to mind the old saw about people with nothing but hammers seeing only nails everywhere they look. The two men were writing a quarter of a century after the birth of radio astronomy, a fact that surely helped them in their effort to expect the unexpected. As with my and Bialy's light sail hypothesis, humans seem to be better at seeing the technological signature of alien civilizations after we have developed the technology ourselves. Cocconi and Morrison's paper immediately inspired the astrophysicist Frank Drake, also at Cornell. In 1960, he decided to conduct just the kind of search that Cocconi and Morrison encouraged. Using the National Radio Astronomy Observatory of Green Bank, West Virginia, Drake conducted a search of two nearby sun-like stars, Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani. For 150 hours spread out over 4 months, Drake used the radio telescope to seek a discernible signal indicating intelligence, with no success. The sense of whimsy with which Drake undertook his search for extraterrestrial life is captured in the name he gave the project, OSMA. It derives from a character invented by the novelist L. Frank Baum in his Land of Oz books. Drake's project became the stuff of broad interest and popular media coverage. That about 200 hours of observation discovered nothing hardly dimmed public enthusiasm. And on the updraft of that interest, in early November 1961, Drake participated in an informal conference sponsored by the National Academy of Sciences at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. It was there that he first articulated the Drake equation, which he used to estimate the number of actively communicating extraterrestrial civilizations. The equation now graces T-shirts, informs the plots of young adult novels, was misused by Gene Roddenberry to bestow a patina of plausibility to the television series Star Trek, and has been roundly critiqued and tweaked by scientists ever since. Lost in the dust and noise is the simple appreciation that the equation is nothing more than heuristic, a shorthand tool to factor out the different terms that affect the success of SETI. Its standard expression is N equals R star times F sub P times N sub E times F sub L times F sub I times F sub C times L, where the terms are defined as N, the number of species in our galaxy that possess the technology necessary for interstellar communication. R star, the rate of star formation in our galaxy. F sub P, the fraction of stars with planetary systems. N sub E, the number of planets in each system with environmental conditions amenable to life. F sub L, the fraction of planets on which life arises. F sub I, the fraction of planets on which intelligent life arises. F sub C, the fraction of intelligent life that develops sufficiently sophisticated technology to take part in interstellar communication. L, the duration of time such intelligent life is able to produce detectable signals. Unlike most equations, Drake's was not designed to be solved. Rather, it was intended to serve as a framework for thinking about how many intelligent civilizations might occupy our universe. It is unlikely we will ever be able to plug in values for all of the variables, let alone determine their output. While Drake was not alone in formulating a framework for seeking extraterrestrial intelligence, Ronald Bracewell came up with a different approach in 1960, and Sebastian von Herner, a German astrophysicist, yet another in 1961, his was the one that has since, for good or ill, become the touchstone for SETI science. I say for ill because Drake's equation focuses solely on the transmission of communication signals. He limited his aspirations to finding N, and from it, the number of interstellar communications that would establish the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence. This exclusive interest in communication predicts the equation's second limitation, epitomized by its variable L, which represents the length of time an intelligent species would be able to produce such signals. Consider, for example, that our species has been producing pollutants that are detectable by certain telescopes for centuries, but radio signals for mere decades. Both N and L point to a deeper problem with the Drake equation. For all its value as the first systematic effort to identify the variables involved in estimating and thereby directing efforts to find extraterrestrial intelligence, the equation's very formalism was perhaps its biggest limitation. When SETI scientists failed to come up with evidence of alien radio signals, critics were happy to declare the equation and all of SETI whimsy through and through. In 1992, in keeping with the search for N, the U.S. government gave $12.25 million to NASA to initiate a radio astronomy program. The very next year, SETI funding was ended. At the time Congress withdrew its support and the funding, one senator, Richard Bryan of Nevada, declared, "Millions have been spent, and we have yet to bag a single little green fellow." There are few more succinct statements of the ignorance and flawed assumptions that have hampered humanity's pursuit of the answer to, "Are we alone?" The sum spent was paltry, comparatively, and the bar set for evidence of success was absurd. That said, the early SETI researchers rarely helped their own cause. Their near-exclusive focus on seeking radio and optical signals has set unhelpful presumptions, scientific and popular, as to what such exploration looks like and what sorts of projects merit funding. Only recently have we witnessed growing interest in seeking biosignatures, such as oxygen and methane in the atmosphere and large-scale algal blooms in distant oceans, and technosignatures, such as markers of industrial pollutants in planetary atmospheres and localized heat islands that suggest urban settlements. In the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the members of this niche are still finding their footing, and the broader scientific community that ought to be supporting them largely is not. Human science still needs to mature in regard to SETI as well as other frontiers of our limited imagination. I keep a file drawer in my office that is labeled simply Ideas. It holds a single hanging file in which I keep manila folders. Sometimes the file is overstuffed, sometimes less so. In each folder are a few sheets of paper displaying equations. These reflect problems and questions that occur to me and that are worthy of answers. They often keep me company during my walks in the backyard of my home and the nearby woods. At the risk of sounding cliched, I usually come up with them during my shower. Recently, after a Dutch film crew visited our shower in an attempt to document my inspiration, my wife bought me a waterproof pen and whiteboard. Well before I had a drawer for collecting ideas, let alone undergraduates, graduate students, and postdocs to share these ideas with, I was gathering them. They have served as seeds from which my own research has grown. To date, those seeds have yielded more than 700 published papers, 6 books, including the one you're listening to, and a growing number of now-confirmed predictions touching on the birth of stars, the detection of planets beyond our solar system, and the properties of black holes. This is not to say that I am guided by imagination alone. All my studies reflect an unshakable guiding principle: contact with data. I avoid mathematical speculations, or what I call theory bubbles. Too often, astrophysics can lose itself in theories that float free of any evidence, taking funding and talent with them. There is one reality out there, and we are very far from exhausting all of its anomalies. As I have told generations of students, it is dangerous to wander into work on abstractions that hold little to no promise of feedback from data. I am sure many of them have felt that it is equally dangerous to pursue lines of research or advance conclusions that are against the scientific mainstream. I think that this reaction is not only a shame, it is also dangerous. While the past several decades have offered much encouragement to the search for extraterrestrial life, I am repeatedly struck by the extent of what remains untried, under-theorized, underfunded, and among a broad swath of scientists deemed best left unmentioned. When I described to my colleagues the reactions of my undergraduates to the 2 thought experiments that opened this book, many of them chuckle. I think that we should pay closer attention and ask ourselves if there isn't a professional truth hiding in plain sight of the students' responses. Unlike what trends on social media, scientific progress is measured by how close a proposed idea is to evidence-established truth. That widely accepted fact suggests that physicists would measure their success by how well their ideas align with data rather than by how popular those ideas are. But that is not what we discover when we survey the landscape of theoretical physics. Fashions frequently dictate funding, sometimes despite anything close to a commensurate return on investments. Despite the absence of experimental evidence, the mathematical ideas of supersymmetry, extraspatial dimensions, string theory, Hawking radiation, and the multiverse are considered irrefutable and self-evident by the mainstream of theoretical physics. In the words of a prominent physicist at a conference that I attended, "These ideas must be true even without experimental tests to support them, because thousands of physicists believe in them, and it is difficult to imagine that such a large community of mathematically gifted scientists could be wrong." But go beyond the group think and look more closely at these ideas. For instance, supersymmetry. This theory, which postulates that all particles have partners, is not as natural as prominent theorists predicted it would be. The latest data from the Large Hadron Collider at CERN did not find any of the evidence expected at the energy scales it probed to support supersymmetry. Other speculative ideas pertaining to the nature of dark matter, dark energy, extra dimensions, and string theory have yet to be even tested. Imagine that the data suggesting that Oumuamua is extraterrestrial technology is stronger than the data suggesting supersymmetry theory is valid. What might follow? Just a bit under $5 billion was spent to construct the Large Hadron Collider, a particle accelerator built in hopes of attaining confirming evidence of supersymmetry, and running it costs another $1 billion a year. If the scientific consensus eventually gives up on the theory, it will do so after vast expense and generations of effort. Until we have invested similarly in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, flat declarations about what Oumuamua is and isn't should be judged accordingly. A host of theories beyond supersymmetry, the multiverse leaps to mind, are given thoughtful, respectful attention in and out of the academy despite the absence of evidence for them. That should give us pause, and not because of the absence of evidence. Rather, it should concern us because of what it reveals about the scientific enterprise itself. What stands in our way of the fair consideration of Oumuamua being of extraterrestrial design isn't the evidence or the method of its collection or the reasoning behind the hypothesis. What most immediately stands in our way is a reluctance to look past the evidence and reasoning at what should follow. Sometimes the problem lies with the message, sometimes with the messenger, but when both run up against a recipient who is reluctant to listen, a problem greater than evidence and reasoning stands in the way. There are many reasons that the search for extraterrestrial life has attracted far less attention and intellectual firepower than many of the anomalies the universe confronts us with. Certainly, the often absurd plot lines of many works of science fiction haven't helped. But neither have the prejudices of astronomers and astrophysicists, biases that cumulatively have had a chilling effect on new generations of scientists. Today, a young theoretical astrophysicist is more likely to get a tenure-track job by pondering multiverses than by seeking evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence. This is a shame, especially because budding scientists are often at their most imaginative during the early phases of their careers. During this fertile period, they encounter a profession that implicitly and explicitly reins in their interests by stoking their fear of standing outside the mainstream of science. An earlier generation of theoretical physicists was open to the humility of seeing their theories proven wrong by experimental data. But a new culture, one that thrives in its own theoretical sauce and exercises influence over award committees and funding agencies, is populated by advocates of popular yet unproven paradigms. When scientists double down on supersymmetry despite the Large Hadron Collider finding no evidence for it, or when they insist that the multiverse must exist despite there being no data to support the theory, they are wasting precious time and money and talent. And we have not only finite funds to spend, but finite time. The irony is that many grown-up scientists once understood this intuitively. After young children open their first checking accounts, they often fall into the trap of imagining the possible amounts of money accumulating there. As they contemplate this purchase and that purchase and all they wish they could own, they get very excited. But after going to an ATM and learning how much money is actually in their accounts, their castles in the air come crashing down. Not only are their funds insufficient to do all that they were dreaming of, but they finally grasp the slow pace at which those funds accumulate. Usually, children will come away from this disappointment having learned to check their accounts with some frequency and balance their dreamed-of purchases against the hard evidence of confirmable data. A scientific culture that has not learned this lesson, that does not require external verification in observable, confirmable data, and that advocates for ideas deemed inherently correct due to their mathematical beauty, strikes me as a culture at risk of losing its grounding. Getting data and comparing it to our theoretical ideas provides a reality check and tells us that we are not hallucinating. What is more, it reconfirms what is central to the discipline. Physics is not a recreational activity intended to make us feel good about ourselves. Physics is a dialogue with nature, not a monologue. We are supposed to have skin in the game and make testable predictions, and this requires that scientists put themselves at risk of error. In the age of social media, the sciences generally and astrophysics specifically need to recover their traditional humility. Doing so shouldn't be difficult. Gathering experimental data and ruling out theoretical ideas need to become greater priorities. It is reassuring to be guided by data, and it also promises more tangible, applicable rewards. Rather than spending one's entire career going down mathematical alleys that will be regarded as irrelevant by future generations of physicists, young scientists should focus on those areas of research where the value of ideas can be tested and cashed in during their lifetimes. There is no field of research where the risk and reward calculus is greater than in the search for extraterrestrial life. What is more, with just 11 days' worth of accumulated data gleaned from Oumuamua's passage, we already have more suggestive, observable evidence than we do for all the fashionable thought bubbles that currently hold sway in the field of astrophysics. There is value in paying attention to the intuitive leaps that children make, for they do so far more easily than many adults who carry ego-loaded baggage or intellectual prejudices. When my daughters Lotem and Cleel learned that their father was working to send a star chip to the vicinity of Proxima B, which sits in the habitable zone of Proxima Centauri, they grew curious, and they grew even more so when I told them the planet is expected to be tidally locked, to always show one side to the star and one side to the dark expanse of space. After a moment's thought, my younger daughter Lotem declared that this being the case, she would need two houses, one on the permanent night side for her to sleep in, and the second on the permanent sunset strip where she could work and take her vacations. It would be wrong to assume that Lotem's imagining of interstellar real estate was merely fanciful. Thought experiments consistent with the laws of physics are the very stuff of discovery, the means of working our way toward the solutions to the many anomalies we confront here on Earth and beyond it. In the less rigid thinking of children, we may well find the insights that propel science and humanity forward. And one of the worst mistakes we can make is to impose conservative presumptions on the ideas and instincts of others or laud intellectual caution for the wrong reasons. Science is, first and foremost, a learning experience, one that works best by keeping us humble when we make mistakes, like children figuring out the world through their collisions with it. Just like the sharp edges of furniture, anomalies are rarely beautiful when we are first introduced to them. They confound what we think we know, stand in opposition to theories and beliefs we take as given, and resist efforts to make them align neatly with our presumptions. That is precisely when science must give priority to evidence over imagination and follow that evidence wherever it may lead. In the late 19th century, for example, physicists noticed something weird about blackbody radiation, the light emitted by heated objects. The blackbody radiation spectrum features a single peak whose wavelength depends on temperature. The hotter the object, the shorter the wavelength of peak blackbody emission. Think of stars. Small, cool dwarfs are red, warmer stars, such as our sun, shine yellow, and the biggest, hottest stars are a sizzling blue. Try as they might, physicists couldn't explain or accurately model the spectral shifts at high temperatures, until 1900, when Max Planck proposed that objects absorb and emit energy in discrete units, or quanta. This revolutionary insight ushered in quantum mechanics and the era of modern physics. No less a genius than Albert Einstein was puzzled by the weird properties of the quantum world, specifically the phenomenon of entanglement and the idea of quantum non-locality, the mysterious ability of two particles to engage with each other no matter how far apart they are. He grappled with this unusual idea and ultimately referred to it as spooky action at a distance. Recent experiments tell us that he was wrong to dismiss this behavior, and it turns out that the more we understand about non-locality, the more it reveals about the very nature of reality. Science, at its core, demands humility, an understanding that humanity's imagination is incapable of mapping out the full richness and diversity of nature. But the proper response to humility is wonder, and with it, a desire to open ourselves to a greater range of possibilities. Within science, this frequently means making difficult decisions. Choices, often made outside the immediate influence of scientists, channel efforts toward certain possibilities and away from others. For example, while the number of large telescopes on Earth is constantly increasing, there are not enough of them to keep pace with the number of astronomers eager to access them. To adjudicate the competing demands for allocated time, institutions and universities have formed committees and funding agencies. They approve and prioritize submitted requests, applying the committee's expertise, but also, inevitably, their biases and presumptions. I have often thought that all such decision-making bodies should automatically dedicate a significant portion of their resources, say 20%, to high-risk projects. Like a financial portfolio, humanity's investments in science need diversification. Yet many researchers stray far from this ideal, especially after they've lost their youthful enthusiasm and ascended the career ladder to tenured positions of prominence. Instead of taking advantage of their job security, they create echo chambers of students and postdocs who amplify their scientific influence and reputation. Honors should be merely the makeup on the face of academia, but they too often become an obsession. Popularity contests are outside the scope of honest scientific inquiry. The scientific truth is not dictated by the number of likes on Twitter, but rather by evidence. One of the most difficult lessons to impart to young scientists is that the search for the truth can run counter to the search for consensus. Indeed, truth and consensus must never be conflated. Sadly, it is a lesson more easily understood by a student starting out in the field. From then on, year after year, the combined pressures of peers and job market prospects encourage the tendency to play it safe. Astrophysics is hardly the only academic field prone to these forces, but the explicit and implicit encouraging of conservative science is both depressing and concerning, given the extent of anomalies the universe still contains. While it is not obvious to me why extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, evidence is evidence, no? I do believe that extraordinary conservatism keeps us extraordinarily ignorant. Put differently, the field doesn't need more cautious detectives. If the flame of inquiry is to continue, it is incumbent on senior scholars to not only gather to themselves promising young scholars, but to cultivate an environment within which the next generation of scientists can nurture discoveries despite their inherently unpredictable nature. Budding scientists are like matches. and the context within which they do their work is like a matchbox. It does no one any good if, at the moment you need them to set a new fire, they strike against the side of a worn, smooth matchbox. A long-learned professional lesson is this. If you want to nurture new discoveries, it helps to construct new matchboxes. Scientific progress has been stifled many times over the years because the gatekeepers who established and enforced orthodoxy believed they knew all the answers ahead of time. To state the obvious, putting Galileo under house arrest did not change the fact that the Earth moves around the sun. Centuries later, the world is unanimous in siding with Galileo. But if that is the only lesson we take from that moment in time, I worry that we will fail to learn another crucial insight. Our debts run to both Galileo and to the authorities who muzzled him. It is not enough to celebrate the first. We must also learn to guard against the second. Surrounded by the technological comforts of the 21st century, scientists imagine ourselves the descendants of Galileo rather than the descendants of the men, it was entirely men, who muzzled him. But that is an error akin to a scientist cherry-picking data. Our civilization is the product of not just our scientific advances, but also those moments when, for any number of reasons, advances were delayed or even stopped in their tracks. We stand where we stand today because of the men and women who looked through the telescope, but also because of the men and women who refused to. Science is a work in progress, and the pursuit of scientific knowledge is never-ending, but that progress does not follow a straight path, and the obstacles encountered are sometimes of humanity's own making. Unfortunately, the humility accompanying our never-ending learning experience is, as in the case of Oumuamua, sometimes forgotten out of hubris, whether exercised by ecclesiastical authorities, secular authorities, or sometimes scientists who declare victory prematurely and assume a line of inquiry has reached its end. Examples of the last instance are myriad. A brief sampling of such moments can help us decide if we're too rapidly closing the door to every hypothesis the evidence concerning Oumuamua supports. Consider that in 1894, the prominent physicist Albert Michelson argued, after surveying the great advances in physics realized during the late 19th century, "It seems probable that most of the grand underlying principles have been firmly established." An eminent physicist remarked that the future truths of physical science are to be looked for in the sixth place of decimals. In contrast, over the subsequent several decades, physicists witnessed the emergence of the theories of special relativity, general relativity, and quantum mechanics, theories that revolutionized our understanding of physical reality and thus disproved Michelson's forecast. Similarly, in August 1909, Edward Charles Pickering argued in a Popular Science Monthly article that telescopes had reached their optimal size, 50 to 70 inches, and there was thus little point in building instruments with larger apertures. Much more depends on other conditions, especially those of climate, the kind of work to be done, and more than all, the man behind the gun, Pickering wrote. The case is not unlike that of a battleship. Would a ship 1,000 feet long always sink one of 500 feet? It seems as if we had nearly reached the limit of size of telescopes, and as if we must hope for the next improvement in some other direction. Pickering was mistaken, of course. Telescopes with larger apertures collect more photons, allowing scientists to see farther out into the cosmos and deeper into the past. Pickering directed the Harvard College Observatory from 1877 to 1919. And his unfortunate words, therefore, carried a lot of weight, especially on the East Coast. As a result, the West Coast became the center of observational astronomy in the United States for decades to come. It happened gradually. In December 1908, George Ellery Hale's 60-inch telescope at Mount Wilson Observatory in California achieved first light. This was within Pickering's declared optimum range, and even as Hale's telescope became more productive, Pickering and the East Coast stayed complacent. Hale, charting his own course, did not. Hale soon built a 100-inch telescope. It began operations at Mount Wilson in 1917 and was used by Edwin Hubble and Milton Humason shortly thereafter to determine that the universe is expanding, one of the 20th century's seminal discoveries. That 100-incher was the biggest optical telescope in the world until 1948, when one twice as wide came online at California's Mount Palomar Observatory. During its long career, the 200-inch Palomar telescope helped astronomers discover radio galaxies and the active galactic nuclei known as quasars, which are fueled by gas falling into supermassive black holes, among many additional new sources of light. And telescopes have just kept getting bigger, all the way up to the present day. Multiple 10-meter instruments are in operation currently, and three extremely large telescopes with apertures of 24.5 meters, partnered with the Harvard College Observatory, reclaiming some of the ground that Pickering lost, 30 meters and 39 meters, respectively, are scheduled to come online in the next decade. Their large diameters will offer unprecedented angular resolution, and their large collecting areas will make them sensitive to faint, previously undetectable sources. Pickering had erred due to his arrogance. Not personal arrogance, but professional arrogance. He thought what his generation of scientists observed, understood, and determined was of interest was the peak of discovery. He didn't appreciate that the ascent of science is one false peak after another. Unfortunately, Pickering was not unique in this particular blunder. Indeed, it is a recurrent mistake throughout the history of science. In 1925, Cecilia Payne, later Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, became the first Harvard student to earn a Ph.D. in astronomy, although the degree was officially awarded by Radcliffe, as Harvard did not grant doctorates to women at the time. She concluded that the sun's atmosphere was made mostly of hydrogen. When reviewing her dissertation, the highly respected director of the Princeton Observatory, Henry Norris Russell, argued that the sun's composition could not be different from that of the Earth and dissuaded Cecilia from including her conclusion in the final version of her thesis. While attempting to prove her wrong in subsequent years through the analysis of new observational data, he realized that she was right. Arrogance again retarded a field when, in the mid-1950s, Charlie Townes encountered stiff resistance as he attempted to demonstrate the feasibility of the MASER, short for Microwave Amplification by Stimulated Emission of Radiation, which would, once built, amplify radiation at a frequency particular to a given element. Two Nobel laureates, Isidore Isaac Rabi and Polycarp Kusch, visited his laboratory at Columbia University in 1954 and implored him to cease his experiments on ammonia, insisting that the device would never work. Luckily, Townes persevered, and masers became the timekeeping devices in atomic clocks and were widely used in radio telescopes and deep space spacecraft communication. In collaboration with a number of scientists, Townes did pioneering work with masers that led directly to the development of lasers. Here's an even more recent example. I once asked a prominent astronomer who studies objects in the Kuiper Belt, the ring of icy bodies beyond Neptune's orbit, if he was looking for brightness changes way out there that might indicate artificial light. He scoffed at the very suggestion. Why? There is nothing to look for. The establishment initially regarded Kuiper Belt objects, KBOs, as imaginary constructs. Pluto was the exception, of course. The largest KBO, it was discovered by Clyde Tombaugh in 1930 and thought to be a planet. But more than half a century later, UCLA astronomer David Jewett couldn't get telescope time or funding to hunt for KBOs, so he piggybacked his search with other projects. In 1992, he and Jane Liu finally discovered the first non-Pluto KBO using the 88-inch telescope at the top of Hawaii's Mauna Kea. In each instance, a leap forward was forestalled, and it was not because of a lack of available technology or an absence of imaginative curiosity or the unavailability of testable data. The delay stemmed from the arrogance, often well-intended, of influential gatekeepers. And as much as we now celebrate the wonders of ever larger, grander telescopes and the world of possibilities they open up, what might have followed had scientists made these discoveries years, generations earlier? Many scientists see themselves as a breed apart, members of an elite intelligentsia. Consciously or subconsciously, they want to separate themselves from the rabble. Such thinking motivates, at least in part, an argument made by many scientists I know, that scientists should communicate with the public only after they figure something out to a certainty. If laypeople knew the messy reality of science, that it's full of starts and stops and dead ends, they'd brand every result as preliminary or questionable, the reasoning goes. Every important scientific consensus, such as the effect of human beings on Earth's climate and the potentially disastrous consequences for us and all other life on the planet, could, some scientists fear, be summarily dismissed. This withholding strategy has the added benefit of making scientists look smarter than we actually are, and adding to its appeal, it limits outside criticism. But this approach is wrong. Keeping the public informed is our duty, and not just because so much scientific research is taxpayer-funded. A public that is deeply informed, engaged, and enthusiastic about scientific advances is a public that directs not just its financial support, but the interest and efforts of its children, its brightest minds, toward the most confounding challenges. In that spirit, being more open as to what we know and what we do not will increase scientists' credibility over the long haul. Shutting the public out until the very end can also lead to mistrust. After all, the anomalies we confront are not for scientists alone. They confront all humanity, and when there are breakthroughs, much like medical advances, it is to the benefit of everyone. We should show the world our work in progress, especially when it is full of uncertainties and buffeted by competing interpretations due to lack of conclusive evidence. We should let everyone see how surprised we often are at what we find. Also, the general opprobrium with which the Academy has met undergraduate interest in SETI has had a chilling effect on graduate student interest. By one estimate, only 8 scholars worldwide have completed doctorates in transparently SETI subjects. But that may be changing a little. As I write, 7 graduate students are currently on track to receive PhDs in SETI-related subjects. What sorts of questions, and consequently, what sorts of experiments in pursuit of what kinds of data ought we to encourage in the next generation of astronomers? Here again, Oumuamua nudges us if we care to pay attention. The traffic of technological equipment through interstellar space might be startling, but it's not noticeable until we develop instruments that are sensitive enough to detect it. Indeed, I have sometimes, with a tip of the hat to Yuri Milner, described the search for extraterrestrial life as the ultimate venture capital investment of scientific research. Any search method is, like investments, risky. With SETI, we have few clues regarding the properties of the needle we are searching for in the haystack of the universe, but if any needle is found, the reward will be tremendous. The return on such an investment would greatly eclipse other, narrower scientific interests. Just knowing that we are not alone would transform humanity itself, to say nothing of the knowledge we might gain from such a discovery. I know it can be hard, especially for young scientists, to advocate for ideas deemed outré by the establishment. At this point in my life, I have considerable career stability as well as an inherent disinclination, one that traces back to at least my first day of first grade, to seek the approval of others. Even so, I might not have been ready to advance the Oumuamua is an alien light sail hypothesis or explore the possibilities it contained had not the fragility of life and the window of time each of us individually has to advance the common good been brought keenly to my attention. For this, my scientific work on the universe was partly, although not entirely, to blame. Chapter 8. Vastness. When you are in the middle of reading a Sherlock Holmes story, it is easy to forget the vantage point of Holmes. For him, any individual case is, well, just one among many. And Holmes's observation, "Eliminate all other factors, and the one which remains must be the truth," applies to his habits of deduction, whether he says it in The Sign of Four, The Adventure of the Beryl Coronet, The Adventure of the Priory School, or The Adventure of the Blanched Soldier. In this way, productive astrophysicists are not unlike fictional detectives. While not all anomalies are the same, the process of trying to unravel them is. "Eliminate all other factors," orders Holmes. And there is, as it happens, another factor that bears on the question of Oumuamua's origins and purpose. It has to do not with Oumuamua itself, but with the universe that it is touring, a universe that is older and vaster than anything else we know. Its very ancientness and vastness, indeed, may hold the key to unlocking another one of Oumuamua's mysteries. During a family vacation to Cradle Mountain in the highlands of central Tasmania a decade before Oumuamua was discovered, I stepped outside after dinner and looked up. Because we were so far removed from the hubs of civilization, there was none of the usual light pollution that spoils the view from so many of the world's backyards. I stared into a clear night sky. It was overwhelming. Arrayed overhead were the countless stars of our galaxy, the Milky Way, stretching across the sky. Off to the side, I could see the large Magellanic clouds and our nearest galactic neighbor Andromeda, a twinkling, iridescent patch that appears roughly the size of the moon. Some of my joy in the sight was in appreciating the fact that it was not timeless. It is anyone's guess if humanity will be around to witness it, but it is a certainty that what we look up and see tonight is no more eternal than we are. At the time, I was especially sensitive to the universe's impermanence. Just a few years earlier, I had had the original idea of simulating the future collision between the Milky Way and Andromeda. I was particularly fascinated with our distant cosmic future, following on earlier papers where I showed that the accelerated expansion of the universe will leave our home galaxy in a void of empty space. Once the universe ages by a factor of 10, all distant galaxies will be pulled away from us faster than the speed of light, and humanity will be able to observe only the stars in our own galaxy. What would this galaxy look like? Aside from transforming the appearance of the night sky, the gigantic collision with Andromeda could kick the sun to the outskirts of the merged galaxy and establish our new cosmic neighborhood for 10 trillion years to come, until the light from all stars, including the faintest and most abundant dwarf stars like Proxima Centauri, is extinguished. I convinced my postdoc, T.J. Cox, to simulate this future collision, and we reported in 2008 that within a few billion years, long before the sun dies, our night sky will change, and the stars from the two sister galaxies will mix to make a new, football-shaped galaxy, which we named Milkomeda. It was remarkable to recognize, that night in Tasmania, the objects of my studies. the Milky Way and Andromeda galaxies were splashed across the sky in a brilliant cascade of light. Perhaps as a result of seeing them so clearly, I felt my place among them more keenly than I usually did. This is a pleasure of astronomy. By contrast, particle physicists do not have the privilege of seeing the Higgs boson with the unaided eye. But my thoughts that evening were not occupied only with the transformation of our galaxy in the distant future. Uppermost in my mind was the question of how the first generation of stars and galaxies lit up in the very beginning of our universe, the scientific details of the story of the universe's genesis. The cosmic dawn was my first fascination as an astrophysicist. My interest began during my time at Princeton and sharpened with the passage of years. Eventually, my investigation of this mystery would influence my pursuit of another, shaping my thinking not just about the history of our universe, but also about any civilizations with which we may have shared it. When you gaze up on a clear night, as I did all those years ago in Tasmania, the numerous sun-like stars of the Milky Way look like the lights in the main cabin of a giant spaceship streaming through the universe with passengers next to some of these lights. What can we learn about these passengers based on our brief encounter with Oumuamua? What, for that matter, can we learn about ourselves? We date the birth of the universe, the Big Bang, to some 13.8 billion years ago. Fascinating, revelatory work has been done that has produced theory, data, and confirmed predictions concerning the universe's earliest origins, including the common agreement that after the first 100 million years, everything was cloaked in darkness. Until, that is, the first star was born. How did the earliest stars come into existence? After my arrival at Harvard in 1993 with Zoltan Hyman, my graduate student, and An Thul, my postdoc, I worked out a theory to explain their formation. Following the Big Bang, matter was spread more or less evenly across the rapidly expanding universe. That it was spread almost uniformly is crucial, for in some places, we theorized, the cosmos started out slightly denser than average. Slightly in the sense of 1/100,000th more dense. But those slight perturbations were sufficient. That was enough for gravity to start to pull matter into these increasingly dense regions and for clouds of gas, composed mostly of hydrogen atoms, to begin to assemble. Working with pencil and paper, my research team modeled the idea until we reached the point where only more sophisticated computer hardware could advance it further. Volker Braun, a graduate student at Yale at the time, took on that task, and over the past 2 decades, he and other theorists have established that, indeed, the process we outlined for the birth of stars could give rise to the early galaxies. Models and theories are invaluable, but data that proves both remains essential. I wanted to see the gas clouds our theory predicted, which meant trying to find evidence that was about 13 billion years old. When astrophysicist detectives confront the challenges of scale that the universe presents, they can become overwhelmed. They do, however, have one asset without parallel in any other academic discipline. They have the ability to look back in time. Because light travels at a finite speed, the farther out we look, the farther back in time we see. And since the universe had similar conditions everywhere, by peering deep into space, we can view our own past. The deeper into space we look, moreover, the older the objects we uncover. To look at a star 4 light-years away, such as Proxima Centauri, is to look at a star as it was 4 years ago. But if we focus our telescopes on a galaxy that was 13 billion light-years away when its light was emitted, we are glimpsing the universe as it was 13 billion years ago. to peer that far back into the dark ages of the universe, the moment when the clouds of gas from which the first stars arose gathered, is a monumental scientific challenge. It also forces us to contemplate the incomprehensibly vast timescales of the universe. Humans today live, on average, nearly 73 years. To have seen the first lights in the universe come on 13 billion years ago, we would have had to live almost 180 million lifetimes, an idea that is especially absurd considering that the Earth is only about 4.5 billion years old, and that we believe the planet has supported life for only 3.8 billion of those years. Looking into the universe, astrophysicists also come face to face with the physical immensity of the cosmos. We can see light that was emitted earlier in cosmic history. The universe resembles an archaeological dig centered on us. The deeper we look, the more ancient are the layers we uncover. This exhibit of cosmic history continues all the way back to the edge of the visible sphere around us, located at the Big Bang, 13.8 billion years of light travel time. It takes light originating beyond this edge more than the age of the universe to reach us, and so more distant regions are not visible to us. It is very presumptuous for us to assume that we are the only intelligence in this vast cosmos. Even though life as we know it and life as we do not know it may exist on numerous other planets, it is most likely that we will encounter relics of extraterrestrial technologies before establishing contact with any living civilization. This must be kept in mind as we contemplate explanations for the mysterious properties of interstellar objects like Oumuamua. My research on the cosmic dawn contributed to the creation of a new field of study, what has come to be called 21-centimeter cosmology. It is a branch of radio astronomy that maps the universe in three dimensions using radiation from hydrogen atoms that started out with a wavelength of 21 centimeters that was subsequently stretched by cosmic expansion. You may recall that this is the same meter wave radio spectrum that humans fill with the noise of their televisions, radios, cell phones, and computers, an insight that inspired Matthias Zaldarriaga and me to wonder if other advanced civilizations would likewise emit such noise. But my initial interest in 21-centimeter emissions was a means to stare back to a time well before any civilization was possible. At this phase of my career, I wasn't hunting aliens. I was hunting hydrogen. After the Big Bang, hydrogen was the most abundant element in the universe by a wide margin. The early universe was about 92% hydrogen atoms and 8% helium atoms. But at this point, the hydrogen in the universe wasn't emitting any radio signals that we can detect today. That is because in the immediate fiery aftermath of the Big Bang, the vast majority of the ordinary matter of the universe, hydrogen, was ionized. Neutral hydrogen atoms consist of a single proton and a single electron. But at high temperatures and with intense ultraviolet radiation, they are broken, ionized. The hydrogen atom sheds its electron and exists as a single positively charged proton. This changes hydrogen's behavior, or more accurately, the type of radio signal it emits. The electron bound to a neutral hydrogen atom can transition between energy states, higher and lower, and in doing so, emit a photon or light particle in the form of a radio wave 21 centimeters long. But ionized hydrogen cannot. About 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe cooled down enough for electrons and protons to combine and form neutral hydrogen atoms, and we can start to seek the element's telltale signature, 21-centimeter radio waves. For hundreds of millions of years, hydrogen atoms remained neutral, passing between their higher and lower energy states and emitting waves right up until stars and then galaxies began to form. and the hydrogen in the universe was ionized all over again. Stars emit more than visible light. They also emit ultraviolet radiation, which can split hydrogen atoms into their component parts, electrons and protons. When the first stars turned on, they re-ionized the universe's neutral hydrogen atoms. This was less a moment than an epoch, a long period when ultraviolet light from the earliest stars and black holes split the universe's dark fog of neutral hydrogen into protons and electrons. But the changing chemistry of the universe gave astrophysicists data to search for, namely, the absence of 21-centimeter emissions. Ionized hydrogen atoms do not emit these radio signals, but neutral hydrogen atoms do. Thus, the moment when the 21-centimeter emission signal disappears is the moment the stars were born. Like the famous Sherlock Holmes story that turned on the dog that did not bark, this scientific mystery became the case of the hydrogen that no longer produced its 21-centimeter emission. As I write, the search is underway for data that will help us pinpoint when exactly the stars began to shine. In South Africa, a multi-antenna array called the Hydrogen Epoch of Reionization Array, HERA, is currently measuring 21-centimeter emissions from the early universe. The Hubble Space Telescope recently identified a galaxy that flipped its lights on just 380 million years after the Big Bang. And the James Webb Space Telescope, whose first science advisory group I served on decades ago, is expected to launch in 2021 and be able to find galaxies at even earlier times. Under development are the 24.5-meter Giant Magellan Telescope, the 30-meter telescope, and the European Extremely Large Telescope, which has an aperture diameter of 39 meters. Our contact with the data from these efforts has only begun, and with it, the winnowing of explanations for how the stars came to shine. And the answer, when we discover it, will bear immediate relevance to the question of whether intelligence other than our own is out there in the expanse of space. If Oumuamua is alien technology, then it is a near certainty that its designers also looked into the dim past of our common universe and likewise tested out meaning from ionized and neutral hydrogen. To be curious enough to explore space in the neighborhood of one's own solar system or out among the stars is, by definition, to be curious about the universe, what its properties are, what explains its past, and what predicts its future. It is not just that our own curiosity and behavior is our best guide to the curiosity and behavior of extraterrestrial life. It is also true that the insights of science will provide us with the common language we need to make sense of extraterrestrial intelligence, perhaps even communicate with it. Science also provides us with a means of making sense of what we discover, however fleeting, however partially. For if we can build it, the odds are great that another intelligence, if it is out there, has done the same.